this year, somebody died who deserved a great deal more attention in the Western media. His name was Gonzalo Lira. He was an American of Chilean origin, and he lived, to say the least, an interesting life, and that life has one profoundly important story which deserves to be heard because it's of relevance to all Westerners. What is this story? We'll get into that momentarily with J.F. Gariepy, who was a friend of Gonzalo Lira and who did a show about Gonzalo's life. Why that's relevant, find out on this episode of News Site. I'm your host, Joseph Cotto. JF, thank you very much for joining me tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. For those who don't know, JF is a biologist, although he works nowadays as a journalist. He has his own show on Odyssey, and of course he has a presence on Twitter, now called X. I mean, talking about Gonzalo Lira is interesting because he did so many things with his life, but you knew him for several years. You were in contact with him while he was going through his last, I won't say phase, that makes it sound a little too informal, but well, he was perhaps going through the last leg of his journey. And Gonzalo was a guy who definitely did not have to do what he did in terms of covering the Ukrainian war, talking about the broader implications of it. He was a wealthy man, a businessman, who decided to give up a very comfortable life in favor of pursuing the truth as he saw it. And I mean, eventually got him sent to being frank, a Ukrainian gulag where he died. But the story behind all of this has tremendously important lessons for Westerners. So JF, I suppose starting off, how would you describe Gonzalo and how did you meet him?
So Gonzalo Lira is a man who gave something to humanity at the end of his life. He gave us a look into a true frontline war coverage from someone who has stemmed in media coverage, not from the machine of the top-down control of the minds by the elite, which is the initial purpose of media, but someone who truly rose from the kind of bottom-up media of the internet. And he gave us what typically we don't have from this kind of personality, because the internet streamer is a shy species that stays indoor and that doesn't get in trouble. Even when they do so-called IRL streaming, they don't put themselves into too much trouble. Gonzalo Lira decided to go another way and to make a mediatic statement of a very unique type, to go die at a front line, making a point to me about American liberty, American allies, corruption, government corruption. He gave us a very unique insight through this coverage that we would have never gotten otherwise. He gave us a look into the mechanics of the corruption of war. And Gonzalo Lira, first and foremost, was an artist. He was a guy who knew the power of the camera and who was part of a rising generation of YouTuber thinkers that was very unique, of which I was a part of, and I've grown along his side. And it's always been impressive to me how much this guy was animated by a search for truth to the point of self-sacrifice, which is what he's done here.
He very, very strongly believed that the West was setting itself up for tremendous failure in the Ukraine, which is, as we've seen, is true. I mean, obviously, the Ukrainian army now is on its last legs. The Ukrainian military, speaking broadly, is on its last legs, even though it has received an inordinate amount of funding from various Western countries. And Gonzalo Lira, from the beginning, was telling people, I remember his broadcasts, that this was basically that the Ukraine was a paper tiger. He was not supportive of the Russian invasion. He called it what it was, an invasion. But at the same time, he was very, very skeptical of the Ukrainian government not only having any sort of serious long-term opposition to Russia, but he saw the Ukrainian government for what it was, a fake so-called liberal democracy with the pretensions of Western values. And I think that's probably what aggravated the Ukrainian government more than anything else, that he called it out on its facade.
Absolutely. Because without this coverage, you look at the Ukrainian case, the problem of the warmongers of America is massive. They have a massive generational problem where they are faced with an upcoming generation that is not as hippie as the anti-Vietnam protesters of the 70s, but kind of, even if they don't demonstrate hippiness as much as them, they are as much anti-war as these people. And so you're faced with a problem, which is that America has a war machine. The main purpose of that war machine is to dominate other nations. That's the superficial function of the war machine. But the deep function of the war machine is really to redirect state money to private entities that benefit from it. And if you can make this happen outside of the supervision of the check and balances of within US financial systems, then the better. And so we've had for many years people getting rich off of bad political decision making in the war sector. From Afghanistan, Iraq, all of the interventions in the Middle East, for every missile that gets dropped by a Trump, there's a whole tree of deep state agents and their connections within the private sectors that are getting money poured over their head for it. And Ukraine came as another opportunity for these people. So Ukraine was an opportunity to have a highly corrupt nation, one of the most corrupt white nations in the world, where sex trafficking is happening, where people are among the poorest white population out there, high murder rate, high corruption within the political sphere, high murder rate for politicians and people like Gonzalo Lira, who are thinkers. And so you have this big contradiction between America is supposedly out there to liberate the people of planet Earth, to give them American freedom, which if you contrast with the Arab governments of the Middle East back in the Afghan days, maybe you still have a case like this. But when you look at what America has become since then, completely abandoning the concept of liberty, medical liberty, for example, free speech, for example, with our national surveillance apparatus and all that we've been facing under the iron fist of the left censorship, it's kind of ridiculous that we're out there claiming that we're the advancing front of liberty against a supposedly authoritarian Putin who doesn't show as much authoritarianism as the left does in our own nation. So Gonzalo Lira put himself as the contrasting figure in Ukraine to make a statement that no, we are not the advancing front of American liberty. We're just an advancing tree of corrupt business interests that are using these situations to enrich themselves and that don't care about liberty. Joe Biden could have made a single phone call to liberate Gonzalo Lira. What do you think Zelensky would have said if Joe Biden said the same way he said in the past? If you go after Gonzalo Lira, you don't get a single dollar from me. Joe Biden told the story of doing this actually to protect his own son. But when it came to the point of defending a First Amendment principle against a political opponent, he failed at doing it. And in doing so, he has exposed his hand. He doesn't care about Gonzalo Lira. He doesn't care about principles. And the left doesn't care about principle. That's a problem.
It's a major problem, and it's a problem that manifests itself in many different ways in a great many situations. Talking about Gonzalo Lira, though, he was a guy who became very well known online on YouTube and on Twitter for his Coach Red Pill persona, which was this thing where he gave men advice about dealing with not only the opposite sex, but the world. He tried to get them to be as basically adverse to sugarcoating things as possible. That's a nice way of putting it. And obviously his views about relations between the sexes attracted no shortage of controversy, but he had a very attention-inducing niche carved out for himself as Coach Red Pill. But he decided to basically, it's not to say he turned on his views, but he decided to expand his presence online into the realm of, as you mentioned, being a frontline journalist and commentator and basically military analyst. What inspired him to make this radical change?
Well, you have to go into the whole story of the life of Gonzalo Lira. So Gonzalo Lira is someone who has experienced the oppression of the left extremely early. I don't have the dates, but somewhere early, I think in the 90s, Gonzalo Lira is a young man. He's interested in cinematography. He goes to college and he gets a bunch of false accusations by women in this college, and he finds himself being punished by the college in absolutely unfair ways. So already before the woke even existed, before the SJW, before the blue hair feminist existed, Gonzalo Lira sees the corrupt system taking over institutions and is a firsthand victim of it. So very bad luck in life, getting your name tarnished by false allegations. Somehow the bureaucratic nightmare institution he was at believes the woman and he gets in trouble. He then moves on to make a series of movies. And during his cinematographic career, which I don't know much about, that's not an angle of him that I knew much about, but I know that he's fascinated at the movement of cameras. I know he's a cinematographer who puts a lot of love in the positioning of the camera. He likes these things, these framings, and it's fascinating to him. And he makes some money with this and then goes on to business ventures that are super profitable for him, eventually leading him to be rich in the couple of millions of dollars since. So there he is, having seen the sickness of the system, one, having explored his artistic endeavor, two, and three, having benefited from business knowledge and having invested in things that multiplied in value manyfold. So he finds himself a millionaire eventually. And there he experiences dating beautiful woman, and I'm part of what I'm telling you right now is extrapolated from knowing about his personality and having watched a lot of videos, but I don't know exactly. But he gets to have sex with this beautiful woman because he's rich, he's attractive, so he gets to test the dating sector a lot. And myself, in private conversations with him, I mean, we were on Zoom calls and just chilling and discussing, and there would be a beautiful woman just opening the wardrobe behind him, and I was like, oh, that's your new girlfriend. It was kind of fascinating to see the Coach Red Pill, romantic guy, just charming one woman after the other. But I think that ultimately, Coach Red Pill either had it in himself not to be a monogamous man, or he was constantly getting rejected. I don't know if it's the fault of the woman or him, but he was rotating across many women. And yet he had this conception that it's okay, that's how the world is. Like, I'm frustrated when I see a woman not willing to go monogamous, and I'm pissed at this. I think it's a force down onto civilization, but he wasn't. He was living with it, and among the many beautiful girlfriends he's had was an exploration of the Ukrainian world, the Ukrainian dating scene that he had done, where he had gone to Ukraine, had started a family there, because he had enough money to have this filming apartment in the UK, some place in the US, some house in Ukraine. he was able to pull making a family there, a family with children, I believe two, and with a Ukrainian woman who was living on place and at different parts of his life. I'm not sure I fully get the timeline, but I think he may be with her at the moment of making children. He may not be with her at some point in the future, and then he may come back to her in another part of his life. I never really asked too much questions about his private life. I always took what he was willing to reveal to me voluntarily. So there he is. He finds himself with a family right at the center of this, of the new ground for American corruption of the military industrial complex. And he goes into his YouTube career, not knowing that he's going to end up with the Ukraine-Russian war. He goes into his YouTube career because he feels deprived of the opportunity, having had success late in life, having tested the dating sector, having lived a degree of degeneracy to a certain extent sexually. He finds himself sad with the perspective that he will be an old man. And he will be an old man by the time his children are 10. And he may be dead by the time his children are 10, 15. And so he goes on to this whole idea, I need to create a document. My YouTube career will be a document for my children. And if you listen carefully to the old Coach Red Pill videos that have attracted hundreds of thousands of views, you will see that this is a guy talking to his son. This is a guy talking to his son who at that moment when he's filming this, his son is probably 3-4 years old. And Coach Red Pill knows if I can make this survive long enough for when my child is an adult, he's going to have benefited from the fatherhood that I may not be able to provide. And he was right. He will not be able to provide it physically. But his channel survives on the torrents out there and the hard drives out there that will save it to carry it to his children. That was the sense of Coach Red Pill's YouTube career. At no point did he want to become big or make money from it. He was pursuing the truth and pursuing a link to his child that he thought he couldn't have.
That is fascinating. He was obviously a man motivated by something much greater than financial concerns. When you look at how far he went to prove his point, to get the truth as he saw it out to the masses, there are easier ways to make money, to be blunt. What he was doing clearly was a personal mission, and it's a mission he gave his life for. Now, this brings about, we could fast forward to his death, but there are a few things that really should be addressed before that. He was reporting diligently, regularly, about the problems in the Ukraine, not only the military problems, but how the government was treating the people, how the government was oppressing the people. In the West, we are told that the Ukrainian populace really, really, really hates Russia, and they really want to fight for the Ukrainian government. And it's sort of like a Boy Scouts of America style narrative. But the reality is that untold millions of Ukrainians are trying to get out because the military there has a conscription policy. And if one is sent to fight against the Russians on the front lines, there are far more Russians than there are of you. It's very likely you're going to die as a result of that. So a great deal of Ukrainians, particularly men, from teenagers, by the way, when I say men, males, they were trying to flee the country en masse, and some of them succeeded, but a lot of them did not. And Gonzalo Lira, who is not eligible to be conscripted, he saw this going on. He saw how the government that was purportedly fighting with the West on behalf of the Ukrainian people against Russia was in fact sending young men to a certain death, or at least to certainly be maimed, or to have extreme psychological trauma. In the best case, this is the best case scenario, to have extreme psychological trauma that they live with for the rest of their lives. And he spoke out against this, and he was pointing out that the Ukrainian government basically is a racket that would create problems and then demand money as a solution for these problems, not only from the West, which was bankrolling the Ukraine all the time, but from its own people. He would talk about the extreme corruption that the Ukrainian people had to put up with from this purportedly benevolent government. So he really was motivated by concerns that had nothing to do with his own financial gain.
Absolutely. And I think that if you go to the philosophy of media coverage of wars, there are a couple of elements. And when you look back at what Gonzalo Lira has done, he's basically attacked each of these pillars in his own way. Here's a couple of narratives that you will hear about in any war, and Gonzalo Lira totally wrecked them. The first narrative is the obvious victory of your side. One thing that we were kept being told is, oh my God, Russia, Russia became a third world country for the purpose of geopolitical discussion during those years. And you had the big lie on the American side, which was not necessarily told in the rest of the world, but the Americans were deceived into underestimating the will of Russia to win that war and its capacity technologically. And what do we see? We see extremely advanced war of drones. We see the use of modern missiles that may surpass the capabilities of the US in terms of speed or in terms of evasion of anti-air defense. We see that Russia has pulled a high level here of war against a truly poor nation, Ukraine, having been an unprepared technologically for that war, which is why it's such a meat grinder for the poor Ukrainian people who are being forced onto the front line at this point, because they are scratching the bottom of the drawer so much of their society that at this point it is all males that are being grabbed against their will, put in a van, and here you're a soldier now. You're not going to win a war with the bottom of the drawer like this. So you're really doing it to make a point. You're doing it to impose authority. But that's the first narrative that Gonzalo Lira, with a deep analysis of frontline knowledge, of strategies, of military advancement, Gonzalo Lira gave us in his last months. Probably the best technical coverage of war that I've seen in my life. And we have never had anything like this delivered by cable TV. And he made it to Duran Duran very often. And he basically gave birth to a style, I would say, of media, which is how do we get to know the truth about what's happening at the front line when everyone who purchases media time is a billionaire wanting to profit from it, or a politician having to take a side on it? In that context, we could never get the truth. And Gonzalo Lira went with internet tradition, kind of his internet culture, and said, I'm going to be the first one to report the truth. And we got actually very pointy updates, specialized updates on what's the progress on these towns? What's the technique that the Russians are using on, you know, Gonzalo Lira was telling the story of the Russian technique, which consists in circling and closing in the circle, creating a V-shaped form to advance toward into the front line of the other side. We got a look at this that we wouldn't have had anyhow otherwise. A look from a specialist perspective who's there to report about what's happening. So the first pillar that Gonzalo Lira in his style attacked is this misconception of the certain victory.
That's a massive pillar, obviously, to go after. What would you say the second pillar is?
So after this, we talk of the money flow and Gonzalo Lira was stellar in covering what is the money flow that is born from a war. And he documented this from back in the days of Komoyoski working with Zelensky to make a reality TV show before Zelensky was a president. You have to understand the whole trajectory of Ukraine and who made this and why did they make it. You have, years ago, Zelensky being named an actor, a Jewish actor, in a reality TV show meant for the... Not a reality TV show, it was a fictitious documentary type of show, in the sense that it's presented as this could be real or this could become real and this could have been filmed as a documentary, but it's really a fiction TV show. So not a reality TV show, but one... one TV show that kind of mixes elements of reality and fiction. So you have a Zelensky that is put forward to the Ukrainian people back then on TV in a show where he acts as a man who becomes the president of Ukraine and who is pro-European and who's trying to get Ukraine into the European Union. This is not random. This is not just creativity out of nowhere. Oh, let's explore a fiction about Ukraine joining Europe. It is an ordered command of someone. There was someone wanting this to happen politically, and they made a fiction out of it to kind of pre-program and prepare the Ukrainian people to this conception that they would side with Europe, that they would eventually be part of Europe. Now we're faced with the problem that from a Russian perspective, or even from a Ukrainian perspective, this is fundamentally a separation with history. Ukraine has always been on the middle, bridging, making the negotiation on the two sides, but never has it fully sided with a European empire. Never has it fully been integrated. If anything, Ukraine is more a legitimate part of Russia from a very long history perspective, as was made by Vladimir Putin in a case in the Tucker Carlson interview. So from a many thousands of year perspective, you can think of Ukraine as legitimately in Russia. But from any perspective at any time scale, it's not the case that Ukraine fits well within the European Union. Yet this was artificially ordered by a bunch of local warlords and local billionaires that Gonzalo Lira was fearless in covering the moves of these billionaires during the war, how they relate to Zelensky, how they led to the rise of Zelensky to eventually make him a president, and the whole fraud that this Zelensky represents, which is that Zelensky was elected on a campaign of making peace with Russia and not going after DPR anymore, not bombarding his southern, the south of Ukraine, not depriving the Russian-speaking population of Ukraine of rights. So he went on a completely different campaign message than what he did. What he did was the exact opposite of this. So when Vladimir Putin says Zelensky ended up siding with the Nazis, what he really means is Zelensky was a bait-and-switch candidate. He was ordered by billionaires to be pro-European. They have changed the mindset of Ukraine through cultural manipulation. And then these billionaires ordered, whenever it was not practical for them to be for them to see Zelensky be such a peace-loving president, they converted him from the moment of the campaign to his actual action into really a warmonger who would go toe-to-toe with Russia. And Gonzalo Lira gave insight into the whole network of semi-mafioso, semi-businessmen people that exist in Ukraine that made this happen.
That is very much worth bringing up, because the Ukraine is, and has been since its inception as an independent country in the early 90s, a place dominated by organized crime rings. They basically go to conflict with each other at election time. One candidate is the tool of one ring, another candidate is the tool of another ring. And some of these rings are more pro-Western than others on the basis of their economic interests. So it's really fascinating, but this is what the Ukraine is. And I mean, you brought up so many good things. Trying to figure out what to get into first is quite an issue, but I think this is a good place to start. The West is told, obviously, that the Ukraine wants to be Western, blah, blah, blah. In reality, it's the ethnic Ukrainian, which they're very similar to Russians, but they consider themselves to be their own people. They have their own language, which is very similar to Russian, but whatever. There are these ethnic Ukrainians who used to be called Ruthenians, which is the Latin word for Russian, goes to show how similar the Ukrainians and the Russians are. But there are these ethnic Ruthenians who are very pro-European, And they go through with this activism basically to differentiate themselves from the ethnic Russians who are clustered in the east of the Ukraine, who obviously are going to be pro-Russia. It's a very old conflict. The ethnic Russians in the east of the Ukraine, they've always thought of themselves as being Russians. There really was no solid Ukrainian identity because the Ukraine, I mean, it literally means the borderland. That's why historically there's the in front of it. It's a place cobbled together out of different areas. The Bolsheviks created it as a single jurisdiction that they could more easily rule than having to deal with all these different territories that, you know, that would have to have separate governments under the Soviet Union. So that's how the Ukraine came to be. And the ethnic Ukrainians certainly were not well treated by the Soviet Union because they resisted the collectivization of farming. They didn't want to give their farms up to the Soviets. So Stalin basically engineered a famine against them. And these ethnic Ukrainians who survived the famine, which is called the Holodomor, they became so angry that they were vociferous supporters of the Nazis during World War II. That's why Russia talks about Nazi influence in the Ukraine. These Ukrainians were literal Nazis. They're members of the SS. There is that infamous case of the SS veteran being honored by the parliament in Ottawa. This created bad blood with Russia because the Nazis killed millions upon millions upon millions of Russians in different ways. So obviously World War II ends, then there are recriminations against the ethnic Ukrainians, and this creates a simmering rage, which has boiled over into what you see now, which is why you see the ethnic Russians in the eastern Ukraine being very, very, very pro-Russia, but you see these Ukrainians, the Russians in the eastern Ukraine being very, very, very pro-Russia, but then you see these ethnic Ukrainians in the west of the Ukraine being very, very, very pro-European, NATO, US, Canada, UK, whatever. So it's a fascinating dynamic. It's a very difficult dynamic to explain, and I barely scratched the surface of it. It's a terrible, terrible series of issues to get into because they're all very painful. But this is what the West is dealing with. Now, obviously, a really synthetic country like the Ukraine, to say it's pro-Western is ridiculous. It has different factions. But what we can see is that the relationship which even the pro-Western Ukrainians expect to have with the West is one of being subsidized. It's one of getting money, getting support, basically without qualification. And they look at the West as something, not only something to aspire to, but as something of a piggy bank. And this creates a very parasitic state of affairs wherein even the pro-Western Ukrainians look to the tax dollars taken from individual Westerners and Western businesses to fund basically whatever their corrupt government wants. And of course, the Ukrainian government is skimming untold millions off the top of whatever foreign aid they get. To say the least, not all of it makes it to the front lines to battle Russia. So this is unique. It really boils down to a question, which Gonzalo Lira was addressing in a host of ways. But it boils down to a question, this whole thing, of whether or not the Ukraine is really Western, or can it really be Western? And if it's not Western, then why is the West so obsessed with it to the point that it's sending money that it doesn't have over there? And then a guy like Gonzalo Lira documents the absolute carnage which results from this.
Absolutely. And it goes at the art of the contradiction of the American empire, which is you don't become Western by wanting to become Western. What led to America being the place of liberty, the kind of the free world, as we call it? It's a process of selection. It's people that were fleeing, and because they were gathering and reconcentrating fast enough into an area where there were no place for parasitism, or the parasitism could be combated and expulsed, it led to the birth of an American mindset of freedom. And the same could be said of Europe as being kind of a place of escape from the overly bureaucratic and organized system of the Roman Empire. So you have this constant fleeing away from the centers of power and control leads to great nations with great mindsets. But Ukraine doesn't have this. Ukraine has the fatality of being a land empire at the intersection between two gigantic empires who are more like sea-based empire, which is, well, Russia, a very large land, but an access to the sea on its eastern side. Western Europe, a very smaller land, but with a very much great extent of access to navigation. So you have the problem that Americanism is born out of liberty and self-selection. You cannot get into another nation and say, do you want to be American? Do you want to side with us? They never will be, because they have been evolved and selected into a world of negotiation between the forces of the East and the West. And as soon as you're into negotiation, as soon as you're into selling a little bit of yourself to serve the interest of a bigger empire to your West or a bigger empire to your East, you take a different route as a country. You become a servant, you become a potential betrayer. And this is why we see Ukraine oscillates between the West and the East throughout its history, betraying the East more recently with the Yanukovych 2014 coup and everything. But, you know, they've been doing this for decades and centuries.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Ukraine is a place that we know as a country, but it only became a country in the 90s, an independent state. And even then it was independent on paper only because it was really a vassal of whichever organized crime group could get control ostensibly through elections. So the whole Ukrainian thing is really, it's a sour subject. You know, if one is to delve into the history of France or England, just throwing these two countries out there, you'll discover many good and bad things, but there's a rich history, heritage, and culture that you can certainly draw on. That's not the case with the Ukraine. The Ukraine basically is something that popped up yesterday, and now it's promoted to us as this grand thing that is, you know, this free, independent country that has this history going back thousands of years, when in reality, certain parts of the Ukraine have their own histories, and these certainly go back thousands of years, but it's not the history of the Ukrainian state. The Ukrainian state is something that is, highly, highly synthetic. There are, you can watch reruns of episodes on TV that are older than the Ukraine, and yet it's being treated as this country on par with, you know, Spain or or Germany or something like that.
Absolutely. Now moving on to, because I have a third and fourth pillar to talk about. The third pillar that Gonzalo Lira attacked is principled hypocrisy. So you have a narrative first, the first pillar, we will win for sure against Russia. We can't lose. Well, you know, apparently we can't even win against Afghan sheep herder. So I was like, how can the American Empire think that it can win against Russia when it had difficulty pursuing so-called terrorists in a bunch of freaking mountains of a technologically totally undeveloped country like Afghanistan? So that's been totally documented by Coach Red Pill, and he was showing us the levels of the military, the numbers, the tanks, the grenades, etc. Second, the money flow, the corruption, the mafioso that are around Ukraine that are making this happen very dirty. But then Gonzalo Lira also gave us a solid demonstration of a lack of principle on the American side. And this lack of principle starts touching the way in which he died and how he died. So what happens is that even before he totally decided to go to Ukraine and do this coverage, Gonzalo Lira knew that he was probably going to die. He knew that he had something with his heart that was wrong, and he was giving himself not many years, if not many months. And I remember he told me something that seemed very important, but that I couldn't know what he was meaning then. But we were in a private Zoom conversation before he started his Ukraine coverage. And he said, Jeff, I'm just telling you, I'm going to do a major change. You're about to see something spectacular from me. I won't tell you what it is, but things will change, and I've decided to completely renovate my life and do something with it. He told me this, and because I'm a respectful kind of autistic friend, I don't even ask people for more details. I'm like, okay, this is what you wanted to tell me. I take it in. I take it in, Gonzalo. I can't wait to see what it is. And he went straight into Ukraine after saying that to me. A few weeks after, he was moved into Ukraine. And I didn't even know then, because I didn't know that this was going to be around Kharkiv and that he lived there. But he would be right there at the front line and seeing the bombardment of Kharkiv firsthand. So what he demonstrated by being so close to the front line, and this touches upon the video of his arrest. You know, there's one thing that I noticed is that ridiculously, Gonzalo has put books of Putin on his table. Three books of Putin, one saying the history of Russia or whatever, and the other saying the personality of Vladimir Putin, a full book. Three very thick books. And to me, this is Gonzalo Lira getting to the point of the principles. Can I be reading some information at the front line of the American Empire that is typically a Russian-sided information? Do we have a First Amendment right to read in America, or living on the lands of America's allies? And I think that this was very intentional. Some people were saying, why would you leave the Putin book on the table? Like, isn't that ridiculous? You're going to get in trouble. I think that Gonzalo Lira decided to get in trouble because I think he wanted to make a statement with these books, which is, look at this. You are claiming that you are the border of LGBT rights in the world. You know how the war machine in this particular generation was so obsessed with convincing leftists to become meat father, a cannon father, that they made this whole case that there would be expansion of LGBT rights in Ukraine, and we were going to modernize this because Ukraine was kind of a traditional society, not very enthusiastic about the LGBT stuff. But that's an example of the American Empire putting the carts before the horse and saying, oh yeah, it's such an open and progressive society, you won't believe it. We'll even have our director of public communication will be a trans, Miss Sarah Castillo, or whatever her name is. And, you know, Coach Red Pill, by buying three books and putting them on the table the moment of his arrest, has called out the bullshit of this whole system. With this single little move, he has proven reading Putin propaganda, even if it's for a documentary or journalistic purpose, will get you arrested in Ukraine. Talking on Telegram will get you arrested in Ukraine. Thinking that, hey, my analysis of the number of tanks is clear, Ukraine will lose, will get you arrested in the American Empire. So you don't have a First Amendment right. The American Empire isn't pushing for an ideology. We are not extending liberty. We are not playing against an authoritarian Vladimir Putin, who is the absolute opposite of us. We really are in the dirty, corrupted politics of money flows and war. We are not principled, and we don't have the moral high horse. When you can attack this pillar of war coverage, you are a stellar journalist, because you made it a cost to yourself and your own life to make a point about ideology and hypocrisy.
That's obviously true. It's fascinating. I would ask some stuff about it, but you have other pillars to get to. Please go ahead.
Well, my fourth pillar, I mean, you can, if you have questions, you can go ahead. My fourth pillar is a short one, but it's so important. The pillar of martyrdom. Any war coverage will include its martyrs. And The War Machine has been very talented at creating martyrdom and patriotic messaging in previous wars. They have totally failed at this one. It used to be that wars would be associated with at least five big Hollywood releases. You know, go back to Terminator. The Terminator with that features John Connor at the heart of the war. And when the movie begins, it doesn't even seem like a science fiction movie. It seems like a war in Iraq type of movie with helicopters, military. You would always have an influence of American intelligence and the American military ordering movies of a certain kind that were featuring war that scenes, that were putting forward the idea of American patriotism, and that were featuring all of the elements of the American army, helicopters, ships, whatever. And including, back in those days, you had so much anti-Arab coverage because they wanted to kind of associate the whole idea of participating to the military as a war against the Arab world. And in this war, they totally failed at having martyrs or great talented people that they would put forward and say, that's the standing example of a soldier. They tried with the ghost of Kiev, the ghost of Kiev, which was immediately debunked. But they never really, you never can think really of a Ukrainian martyr that really stands against the Eastern Russian world. They tried elevating Navalny. Navalny is the closest to what they got. And Navalny was kind of an investment of American intelligence in kind of like the Pussy Riots have been for a generation before. This whole idea of a feminist, punk, free thinker who somehow got victim of the great injustice of the evil, authoritarian, bloodthirsty dictator Vladimir Putin. That is the story they tried building with Navalny. And instead of the five or six Hollywood releases that we typically got in the 90s when called for war, we got one Hollywood release, which is the big documentary that was pushed by CNN, Navalny, I think that's the name of the documentary, which was trying to elevate Navalny as a hero. And amazingly, and this is the sign of just deep intelligence and mischievousness and kind of the brightness and genius of Gonzalo Lira. Gonzalo Lira gave us an anti-martyr that played its hand before Navalny even died, and that even I, as a friend of Gonzalo Lira, couldn't see this coming. But now that I've seen the death of Gonzalo Lira and the death of Navalny, I realized that what Gonzalo Lira was doing was also partly putting himself in the balance of martyrs and saying, hey, you're going to cry for Navalny's death. Navalny died in prison a few weeks ago. He was under the justice system for starting protest in Russia. Now, his protest featured Nazi imagery, and he was believed to be part of the American apparatus of revolution against Vladimir Putin. So it's not like any opposition gets his treatment in Russia. There are political opponents in Russia. It exists. But his type of opposition was judged too dangerous for Russia, and Vladimir Putin eventually pursued a campaign against him of imprisonment and imprisonment for Nazi associations and things that could look ridiculous and that could look authoritarian if we had the moral high ground. But that in light of what we did to Gonzalo Lira, Navalny's death seems like a very, very small detail. And I wonder if it is to be even taken as any form of indication that the Russian world truly differs from America. Because Gonzalo Lira, by making himself an anti-martyr, and by anti-martyr, what I mean is he is a martyr who demonstrates that what we would accuse the other side of doing, we're doing it also. You would want to say, hey, look at how evil Vladimir Putin is. He kept a man in jail and the man died. Well, we kept a man in jail and the man died. We kept Gonzalo Lira in the very same way they kept Navalny. Gonzalo Lira was an opponent to the regime, the local regime at war, which is exactly what Navalny was also. So the death of Gonzalo Lira neutralizes so many moral routes of argument in which the American side could look superior and look like they have the moral high horse, that it shakes me to the core. And when I saw Joe Biden come out the day of the death of Navalny and say, this is a terrible death, it is on Putin to have done this, I experienced a kind of almost magical feeling of release inside of me, because I could take the Joe Biden speech, remove the word Navalny and put Gonzalo Lira, and it would be the first thing I heard from Joe Biden that makes any sort of sense. Like Joe Biden was one word away from making sense. If he said that Gonzalo Lira's death is because of the mistreatment in Ukraine gulag and the lack of fitness between the Ukrainian world and American liberty, Joe Biden would have been absolutely correct, but he was saying it about Navalny. And this is how Gonzalo Lira, through his death, still shines. He still shines because he reminds us that we are controlled by elites that do not care at all about the truth, that do not have principles, that direct money flow illegally to unsupervised areas for the purpose of self-enrichment, and that there is death. There is thousands and thousands of death that emerge from this corruption. And Gonzalo Lira, on top of it, tells us, and you're not going to make this fake coverage around Navalny, because the day that Navalny died, what did we see on Twitter? Gonzalo Lira trending. We saw people, Gonzalo Lira was on everyone's mind. And as such, he was still living through the memories that he left to us.
The question might seem to have an obvious answer, but it has to be brought up. Since Gonzalo Lira was an American citizen, in your opinion, why did the United States not make any move to save him once he was taken into Ukrainian custody, which everyone knows was tantamount to his own death? One sees how far the Biden administration went to get Brittany Griner out of a Russian jail for comparatively minor stuff, just a marijuana charge. So why do you think that the U.S. government did not do what it could have very easily done in far less time that's taken to have this conversation, get a U.S. citizen released from a Ukrainian jail when the charges were so transparently ridiculous?
It's because the people who control this kind of negotiation, the elite that have their claws over Washington, D.C., do not consider that American citizenship is a thing. They consider themselves as the only enlightened part of America, and they in fact hate you more than they hate the enemy or the foreign. They believe that there is a sickness within America, and they believe that the people who have this sickness, which is right-wing thought, which is red pill philosophy, which is whatever Gonzalo Lira had came to be representing, they think that these people are the most evil force in the world, and that they must be intimidated, that we must make an example out of them. We will never save you. If you come to be that low in our view, you are not human to us anymore. And the Democrats' elites, they truly believe that people like Gonzalo Lira are not human. And they're not involved in a patriotic view of America where, oh, well, you know, people have different ideas and we share about it on the basis of free speech and we debate and we decide. No, they see themselves as a new America that must totally eradicate any form of traditionalism, and specifically white people, white men. And Gonzalo Lira was standing there as a free white man to them in the way Brittany Griner wasn't a free white man. Brittany Griner was exactly the kind of demographic that the Democrat elite wanted to put forward to say, hey, we have shown you security among us. We will protect you if you're a trans. We will protect you if you're Black. That is the alliance of the American elite with the Black population that they especially don't like to see. They want you to know that you won't benefit from it if you're a white right winger. So you better get to be allied with us or we will let you literally rot in a Ukrainian jail. That's what they think.
And now talking about Gonzalo Lira's detention by the Ukrainian authorities, how did that come about? He was obviously arrested by them, released. He was essentially told not to flee the country, but it was, as I understand it, a wink and a nod thing telling him to get out. But he chose to stay and he continued broadcasting about the declining fortunes of the Ukraine. And then he was arrested again. And he never got out of the Ukrainian custody. As a matter of fact, when he was trying to leave after, because he did try to leave eventually, and he was arrested when he was trying to get out. And apparently at this point, the Ukrainian authorities, when they had once just wanted him to, you know, vacate the country, they had decided that he had caused so much trouble that he had to be punished. And obviously his punishment was being sent to a gulag. So, I mean, this is a very sort of drawn out thing. His arrests, which led to his death ultimately. I'm sure you can describe this in not only better, but more coherent detail than I have.
Yeah, so there was a couple of misunderstandings. And what I will say about the end of his life in jail is there is a torture, there is a mental torture that happens in his case that may have led him to try to do irrational things at time, but that is truly the signature of a thinker being mentally tortured. So the last, at some point, they arrested him for, you know, making coverage on Telegram, and they released him. They released him. So he thought, okay, well, now I'm free. They deprived him of access to his Telegram, and they gave him various orders not to cover the Ukraine conflict anymore. But he was free, and he was wondering, what's the safest thing? Do I escape Ukraine? Do I stay here? He was very uninformed about what he should do. And he contacted me a few days before his second arrest, which would be his last. He contacted me on Zoom, and I was like, that is dangerous, coach. You're talking to me on Zoom. And he was showing me the hotel where he was located or whatever building he was located. I was like, you know, that there might be people listening. We can be wiretapped. But he was careless about it, and that's fine. You know, I think he made his choice of degree of security, and he may have paid the price for calling me. I'm still wondering in my head if the call he did to me wasn't the reason the intelligence agencies got a hold of his location. But one thing I discovered in this call just before he got finally arrested was that he was in extreme nervousness. He was going through cigarettes. He was extremely nervous. And I was like, why do you call me? We hadn't been talking for months. And ultimately, he just wanted to call me for the reassuring, friendly voice of mine. He wanted... It's the first time in my life, you know how if you have a wife or a girlfriend, you know how hugging her feels good and the presence of the other feels good. But it's the first time a man ever felt the need to just have my presence. And he just wanted my presence. He just wanted to chill. You could see that talking with me was just calming him down. And there was really nothing to be said other than I was giving him praises. I was like, bro, you've done a spectacular mediatic contribution here, and it's an honor to be your friend. But he was just into his bubble of anxiety, and just wanting to chill and be relaxed and not have to think too much. And to me, that's the sign of the torture of a thinker who knew that he wasn't in a free country, who knew that he had committed a thought crime. What I've seen in his eyes that day is truly the suffering that you would expect in someone in 1984 having committed a thought crime and knowing that Big Brother is after him. It was a genuine, it was not acted. I've never felt such genuine distress in a human being other than in very violent situations, but really a mental distress that is hard to describe. And so I let him go after this conversation. They arrested him. There was the whole video of his arrest. And during his time in jail, he got told all sorts of stories by his guards, which to me is further evidence of mental torture. They extorted him money from his Patreon because he had stacked funds in his Patreon. They got access to a lot of it. So they paid themselves in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars by torturing him. They got money from him. They told him fake stories about, why didn't you leave Ukraine? We had freed you for 3 months. That was a sign by the regime that they wanted you out. So they were telling him, you should have left. You didn't leave. So when they eventually released him so that he could have a little bit of liberty, but they told him to stay in the city, Gonzalo Lira thought of everything that he had been told by his torturers, by his guards. They were telling him, you have to escape Ukraine. We're giving you a chance. And when he drove to the border, and he didn't try to go through the forest, didn't try to go through the Russian front line, he tried to go straight to Hungary through the legitimate border people of Ukraine. He tried to go legally. He was thinking, yeah, they want me out. They're giving me a chance. That's why they're freeing me from jail. So they interpreted it as Gonzalo Lira trying to escape Ukraine illegally. But that was Gonzalo Lira truly being tortured mentally and being convinced by his low-level guards, you have a chance to flee now, you should flee. So he took the chance to flee, and they decided to interpret this as an attempt to defraud the Ukrainian state and to evade justice. So now they had some criminal charge against him, some non-ideological charge, and they brought him back in, and they let him die of eudaimonia in his lung. He ended up not even dying from the one thing that he thought he would die from, the one thing that had led him to adopt this lifestyle of, I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well do something important with my life. And amazingly, he didn't die from that. He ended up dying from poor medical care of eudaimonia, which is a kind of water coming into your lung and expanding your tissues, causing all sorts of troubles. But eudaimonia is a very easy thing to deal in the West. So if he had gotten just basic medical care, he probably would still be alive. One of the last things he did is write a letter to his sister that said, I'm dying of eudaimonia. It's a pneumonia that's developing in my lung as a result of poor medical care, and that's it. I'm about to die. And I see nothing in his letter that is ideological. That, you know, this was really a man that at the end of his life was so absorbed by the anxiety and the torture he was the victim of that he couldn't think greater. He couldn't think of the Russian conflict. He was seeing his death, seeing his disease, seeing his torturers. And that's all he was thinking about. So in a way, it wasn't Gonzalo Lira anymore at the moment of his death. It was a man reduced by a system of dirty power that he had once fought.
As we unfortunately begin to wrap up the conversation, there are a few questions. I think it's fair to say that the Ukrainian system of so-called justice was set up so that he would die within it, within a gulag, but it was orchestrated this whole thing so that Lyra would not be, you know, shot in the street or something like that. He was released, it would seem, with the intention of arresting him for a more serious charge, being a fugitive per Ukrainian law. And then they would be able to hold him indefinitely and put him under such conditions that it was certain, given he was not in the best health, that he would die, even though he ultimately died of something other than what he imagined he would. Do you think that's a good way of describing this?
Absolutely. I think it's a martial law justice system, which, you know, I don't think they have a particularly beautiful and working justice system already in normal Ukrainian society. So under martial law, with Zelensky banning political opposition, forget about it. All you're going to have is basically military treatment, and in this case, the military treatment of an enemy.
And what lesson do you think Westerners should take from, I mean, we've been discussing lessons from Lyra's life and work, but what lesson, more than any other, do you think Westerners should take from Lyra's, obviously, his journalism, some will call it activism, perhaps activist journalism, his activist journalism, we'll just say, and how he was treated by the Ukraine and how the West did not come to save him? What would you say is the most important lesson for Westerners to absorb from this terribly sad series of events?
I would say pursue your own self-interest. You know what the world needs. You know there's a thousand things that deserve fixing in this world. If you can spend your life fixing one or two and having children and caring for them well, you're going to be in the on the road that Gonzalo Lyra had chosen for himself. And yeah, Gonzalo Lyra tried doing things in the world that were needed, that he saw were missing. And that's how you become a great man.
And I suppose this would be the last question. I mean, there's just so much that could be brought up, but the time is short. How do you think Gonzalo Lyra will be remembered? Because obviously a great deal of people want him to be forgotten. But as you mentioned, when Navalny died, Lyra was trending on Twitter. So he's anything other than forgotten. He's still brought up quite a bit. Do you think that he will eventually be sort of absorbed into the back pages of history and then forgotten? Or do you think he will be a name that comes up for years, decades, perhaps even generations to come?
I was already shocked that his name would come on the day of the death of Navalny. And so I look forward for the future. I think that what he's done is so great that we might have these waves, these echoes of memories of people saying, hey, you know what? That makes me think of Gonzalo Lyra, maybe in 10 years and 20 years down the line. And I don't think that the current America is so ripped apart by internal conflict and its external actions that I don't think we're ready for an introduction of Gonzalo Lyra into the textbooks of the left. But you can think of an America in 20 years down the line in which the story of Gonzalo Lyra has a place. And in fact, it could have a radically important place. I think that's an interesting probability or possibility.
And this will be the last question. What do you admire most about Gonzalo Lyra? Because obviously you have a great deal of admiration for him. I thought his Coach Red Pill stuff was very interesting, even though I did not always agree with him. I certainly did not always agree with him about his analyses of history and politics to a degree. But my political disagreements with him are much more limited than my disagreements with his analyses of history. But all the same, he's a guy who accomplished a tremendous deal in his life. I mean, there is an epic quality to his story. There is an epic quality to his story. It has not gone away with his death. If anything, his death has only amplified the epic nature of this. What is it that you admire most about Lyra?
I would say it's the cinematographic angle that he had on reality. Most people feel part of the world and they kind of feel at the center of it. They are kind of geocentrist of the old times that think that the planet Earth was at the middle of the world. But most people are still geocentrist socially. They think that they're at the middle of the world and part of it. Gonzalo Lira was a man who was looking at the world and he was fascinated with it. And he was looking really at it like, I have a camera, let's look at it. Here's the truth. Here, and that's what led him to be so interested in the truth and pursuing it so hard. It was this objective, without me even being part of it, I find this thing fascinating and I'm going to show it to you.
He was a fascinating man, to say the least. He obviously had his troubles, but he certainly had his accomplishments. And it is just something else that he was, in this day and age when people online can be whoever they want to be, they can hide behind usernames, avatars, this, that, the other thing. He put his money where his mouth was for sure and lived by his words and died by them. And his death shows us really, as does the work he was doing, which resulted in his death. These things show us what the Ukraine really amounts to. It's not a Western country. It's certainly not a liberal democracy. It is a very dangerous place with many different peoples who hate each other. And the best course of action for the West with regard to the Ukraine is to stay out of it, stay the hell out of it, or else bad things happen.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, JF, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. I really had wanted to have this conversation with you after I heard about Lira's death. It was a terrible, terrible thing when I heard about his death. It was sickening. I can't say I was surprised, but it was just awful. It was one of those things where you're not surprised, but there's just a sort of shock. And he definitely deserves to be better understood. I hope our conversation goes some of the way towards promoting an accurate understanding of who he was, what he lived for, what he died for, and obviously our speculation about what his legacy will be that'll have enduring relevance going forward. Is there anything you would like to add about anything we've discussed tonight before we go?
No, I've laid out my case, and I hope that this is part of what we remember. In internet culture, we lose so much. Who knows? We may have lost some of Gonzalo's videos already if someone doesn't save them, but hopefully my oral memory here gets transmitted for as long as we can.
Absolutely. I'm very glad that the discussion was broadcast to X. If it were broadcast to YouTube, that would be a real problem. I did catch your episode about the passing of Susan Wojcicki's son. And to say the least, that was a very hardcore perspective you had. But, it's one of those things where on an emotional level, what happened with her family is sad. But then you think about all the pain and suffering she inflicted upon others, literally. Fear of people losing their lives,
including Gonzalo Lira.
Yes.
Gonzalo Lira was also, despite all the great things we talked about, Gonzalo Lira was one of the first targets of internet censorship. And I think there is something about his personality that was detected to be anti-warmongering in advance by the powers that be, and they didn't want a free man like this to tell us about peace.
No, absolutely not. He was profoundly inconvenient for, shall I say, the narrative. And people like Susan definitely enforced the narrative. Now she's the former CEO of YouTube. But I was surprised when I saw so many people sort of dancing on the grave of her late son. And of course, it's fair to say that you had the accordion out with a bottle of beer doing a jig. But as awful as her son's death was, you could sort of see where the rage comes from because of the damage she did. And she's sort of like the face, the personification of the censorship system that can drive people insane. And in other cases, it drives people to do what Gonzalo did, which was ruthlessly pursue the truth. He had his own personal motivations, but certainly what was going on with tech censorship made him feel that the truth was all the more important. It's something he lived and died for. So we see what's going on with regard to his life being an example or a sign of the times. Then you see the reaction to the death of Wojcicki's son, same thing. And what this tells me is that we live in truly troubled times. And I hope that things get better, but I do hope, perhaps more realistically, that this conversation goes a long way towards giving people an understanding of Gonzalo Lira, because he absolutely was a man of his time. And he will have he does have so much to teach people during times going forward about no shortage of things. And I certainly think you've done a great service as someone who knew him for years by coming here tonight to explain your views about the man, his work, his death, and what it all means.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
It absolutely was a pleasure to speak with you, JF, and I hope to do so again very soon. Everyone, thank you very much for having tuned in. I hope you found this conversation to be interesting and worthwhile as JF and I have. Gonzalo Lira is definitely someone who deserves to be remembered, and I hope that he will be for years, decades, generations to come. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.